You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, let's do this. Welcome to Locked On Heat, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. My name is Wes Fulberg. I'm here as always with Dave Vermeil, and we are opening up the mailbag because that's what we do on Mondays. Let's jump right in. Our first question: how does Gordon Hayward not making the All-NBA team impact the chances he signs in Miami? That question from Champagne Poppy on Twitter. I don't think it's Drake. It could be Drake, but I'm pretty sure it's not Drake.
It seems unlikely. I think he might be a little bit more connected than just going through the Locked On Heat podcast. Not that there's anything wrong with what we present out there. In fact, just the opposite. But I'm going to say, as part owner of the Toronto Raptors, he probably has a little bit of an inside track on what's going on.
And probably no interest in Gordon Hayward because he's not going to Toronto. Like, they might
try. They're overpaying DeRozan already. They've got enough. They're apparently going to re-sign Serge Ibaka for $20 million plus. Kyle Lowry's out there somewhere, so we'll see what happens with Toronto. But enough about them. Our concern is with Gordon Hayward and the possibility of him joining Miami as a free agent. So obviously the All-NBA teams were just announced this past Friday, I guess, and Gordon Hayward was not included among those. So lots of other worthy candidates. That's open for debate. Mm-hmm. A lot of people were a little upset that he wasn't included. Paul George also was another player who wasn't included, and their contracts were directly tied to, or the future contracts were directly tied to, whether or not they were included as on an All-NBA team.
Well, Jimmy Butler made it in over Hayward, right? And Paul George. Do you have a problem with that at all, or?
I think it's really subjective, and I think, to be honest with you, it could have gone one way or the other. I was thinking back on teams that went in a podcast appearance I made a couple weeks ago, maybe even a month ago. I had gone through my preliminary All-NBA team, and I think I included Hayward over Butler. So, I mean, it's pretty subjective. I liked Hayward's impact overall in Utah, the consistency with which they played. Obviously Butler wasn't always in control of what was going on in Chicago, and there were so many distractions off the floor. But either one of them is a worthy selection. It's unfortunate.
I didn't think Paul George had any business being on the All-NBA team at all.
That's fair.
Like, that last month of the season, he was so obviously gunning for the All-NBA roster. I think Indiana's coaching may have gotten some direction to say, make sure this dude's usage rate is through the roof for the next few months, because we need him to make an All-NBA team, or else we won't be able to sign him to a 5-year max. And I don't know if it was that. Look, Paul George is good in the playoffs. He was good in the first round, even though Indiana got swept. But I don't know, man. Like, that regular season of his was just kind of smelly to me. It didn't smell right to me. It seemed like he just kind of went through the motions, didn't want to be there. And then at the end of the season, like that last month, he realized, I got to go get paid. I need to make the All-NBA team. I'm going to go after it this next month. And I don't know, man. He just seems so selfish to me almost.
It's funny because, you know, back in February before the trade deadline, there was a possibility that Miami might enter discussions for George. I don't know if that actually went through anywhere. We don't have no sources indicating that there were talks or anything like that, although I'm sure Pat Riley does his due diligence as always, and Andy Ellsberg, of course. And we talked about the possibility of adding a superstar like George, and, you know, somebody who was a missing piece for a team like Miami that doesn't always have that kind of level of player who draws fouls, who draws the attention of referees and things of that sort. But you're right in that I think the second half of the season kind of put a shadow over everything that he's accomplished. And some of the comments that he made post-game during the playoffs, kind of throwing teammates a little under the bus. I think they were over-magnified just because the podium game takes such a major role during the playoffs. But at the same time, I think they could have been avoided. He didn't have to say the things that he did. There are rumors that he's so interested in going to L.A. His camp has already allegedly reached out to the Lakers and told them not to trade their assets because he's coming there regardless. So there's a lot of things up in the air with George. But let's get back to Hayward, though. So the issue with the All-NBA selection is that because of the way the rule is written in the collective bargaining agreement between the NBA and the Players Union, there is the designated players exception, the DPE, which would allow teams to re-sign their respective players for a supermax deal. You've probably heard that term before, the supermax. In the case of Utah, and Hayward in particular, he could sign a 5-year deal there worth potentially $207 million. So that's what that Supermax is.
But by not making that all-NBA roster, he's not eligible for that anymore. So now he could sign for with Utah at a maximum of 5 years, $177.5 million. Perfect. Or with any other team for a 4-year max contract at $131 million. So the big difference there is that fifth year, right? And so as Jonathan Charks at The Ringer broke down, actually, that's only going to be, for that first 4 years, about a $5.4 million difference. But because Utah can offer more, they could still offer more raises year over year than any other team, right? Because they're holding on to their own player. Right. But that fifth year often gets that fifth year kind of throws off the math a little bit. 5 years, 178 looks a lot higher than 4 years, 131.
Right.
But it's Hayward is probably going to enter free agency even before that. What, regardless of where he signs, he's probably going to get a player option for 3 or 4 years down the road so that he can re-enter free agency as the salary cap continues to grow. It's projected to be at $120 million, almost $20 million more than what it is supposed to be now by the year 2020. So he's probably going to try to get into free agency then. So what we're looking at possibly is 3 years and out, opt out, enter 2020, and sign for an even bigger contract that's going to pay him upwards of $40 million right. a year.
And the same thing will apply that he'll be eligible, again, assuming that he's made an all-NBA team, he'll be eligible again for that DPE where the teams can exceed the cap in order to pay that Supermax. So at the end of it, at 2020, if he's made an all-NBA team over the next 3 years and continue, and you know, considering he's entering his prime and at his prime right now, it seems likely that he'll continue that growth, particularly if he moves to the Eastern Conference where he'll have less competition at the forward position, I assume.
That's a really good point that you make there because we're – look, money isn't going to be the only motivating factor for Gordon Hayward, and it's never is, but it's a big one. And if he says, "Look, I need to make an all-NBA roster, and I need to be I missed the DPE this time. I'm not missing it next time. I'm getting paid." Does it make where not only do I want to win, but I also want to make an all-NBA roster wherever I sign? Which team gets me the best opportunity to do that? And so I looked at the other factor here, which we always hear about Miami, is the no income tax. And that's always kind of thrown out there with Pat Riley and the lifestyle of South Beach, no income tax. It's kind of always like looped in as a motivating factor for players. But just to kind of illustrate the importance of the no income tax, especially in this situation, Utah's got an income tax of 5%. The Celtics, who have, of course, been in, are heavily rumored to go after Gordon Hayward because of the Brad Stevens connection, they've got a 5.1% income tax. The Heat, of course, in Miami, in Florida, no income tax. So in that there, if Hayward were to sign in Miami, he'd actually make more money after taxes than he would even in Utah or Boston over the course of the first three seasons before he's expected to possibly opt out. That's pretty substantial. Even given that Utah can still offer more a higher percent raise year over year, he would still make more money in Miami because of the lack of income tax.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's also that possibility where he can opt out and then re-sign for that Supermax. And I think the numbers are broken down here. You broke down some of the numbers, but also the Ringer's piece there from who was it who wrote it?
Jonathan Charks.
Oh, okay. Actually, I'm sorry. I think it's Kevin O'Connor actually who wrote that piece. Yeah, I think it was. But he, over the course of, let's say, the next 8 years worth, if he signs a 5-year Supermax, assuming again that he's made an all-NBA team over the next 3 years. In Utah, he would make a total before taxes of $341.7 million. If he signs anywhere else, he'd make $339 million. So we're talking about a basic difference of $2 million. And again, after taxes in Miami, he would probably make considerably more than that. So
yeah,
it looks
Miami would be able to pay. He would make, if he were to sign in Miami, he would make $30.3 million after taxes in 2017-18 if they offered him the max.
Right.
If Utah offered him the max and he signed in with the Jazz, he'd make $28.8 million next season. That's almost a $2 million difference in year one. And that continues to be the sort of – and that would be the biggest difference. But the trend is that Miami is still paying him more than Utah after taxes. In year two, 31.8 versus 31 million, so almost $1 million more. And then in the 2019 season, $33.3 million in Miami versus about the same in Utah. So that third year actually would end up being basically even. But in the first 2 years, he'd make more money in that year in Miami than in Utah.
So this is all a very long-winded, heavy on the numbers explanation as to whether or not money will be a factor. And in this case, because of the DPEE and the fact that Hayward didn't make the All-NBA team, to answer Champagne Poppy's original question, it does help Miami's chances
a lot,
assuming that this is the more lucrative option. The Heat would be the more lucrative option financially for Hayward. But all of that could mean very little if money isn't as big a factor as we assume it is for Hayward. I mean, it's nice to have that extra chip there, a bargaining chip, in order to negotiate with Hayward and his agent. But if money isn't the biggest factor for him, if it, as he said, it's about the possibility of winning a title, the comfort level of his family, all the other factors that weigh primarily in free agency, the money isn't necessarily the biggest factor, perhaps.
And it's not even that. It's not even that big of a, like, Miami could pay him more after taxes, but it's not that big of a difference. I mean, by not making the All-NBA team, it just evens the playing field. Now Utah can't be like, you can't pass up $40 million. Like, that's what the difference was. It was a $36 million difference, I think. That's no longer there. It just evens the playing field, basically.
Speaking of evening the playing field, I think the best way for people to find anything that they're looking for, as far as winning, you know, if they're looking for concerts, if they're looking for tickets to games, if they're looking to see Hayward in a Heat uniform next season, I think there's an option that definitely evens the playing team for our listeners.
That's right, because SeatGeek is the smartest and easiest way to find tickets for the game, concerts, shows that you want to go to. It's never been easier to get the seats you want for a great value. SeatGeek has the best deals on every ticket in the house, wherever you want to sit. I've got the SeatGeek app on my phone. It's by far the easiest way I've found to shop for tickets. I can be anywhere, just a few taps. I've got tickets for this weekend or whenever. With SeatGeek, you always get the best deal on every ticket because they price compare for you by searching multiple ticket sites. SeatGeek will always find you the lowest available price, and they want to help you get the most bang for your buck. That's why SeatGeek grades every ticket based on value. You'll immediately see any underpriced seats and be able to find the best deals that fit your budget. Plus, every ticket you buy on SeatGeek is backed by their 100% guarantee, so you can shop with confidence. Best of all, our listeners get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. How do you do it? Nice. Download the SeatGeek app. Go to the settings tab. Click add a promo code. Enter the promo code LOHEAT, and then SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase, which we've discussed before. That's a couple of beers, maybe half of a concert t-shirt, whatever you want. Download the SeatGeek app and enter the promo code LOHEAT today. Get your $20 back rebate.
You know, I wish there was a SeatGeek app or something comparable for the upcoming NBA draft, because I wish something would allow us to find the best value out of all the players that will be available to the Miami Heat at number 14
to win the draft. Maybe we should design that. We should design like a big board that has like big green dots that like signal like this is the best value at your pick.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I guess if we did that, we'd be like millionaires, though, because NBA teams would probably use that.
Yes, and the fact that it would be impossible to predict what their value would be, considering we have no idea how these careers will pan out, which is all of what makes the draft so interesting and or such a terrible crapshoot for some people.
Speaking of the draft, our next question comes from Jeff Nichols. How would you run the lottery if you were Supreme Overlord? Would you wait it for hope, punish failure? Our answer is, first of all, if I'm Supreme Overlord, I'm probably going to handle a few other things before I fix the draft lottery, but it's definitely on the list. It's definitely on the list. Can I just tell you what my idea here is, David? I've put a lot of thought into this.
I would love to hear your idea, Wes.
All right. So, step one, take the playoffs. Take it from 16 teams to 12. Six teams in each conference. So you're eliminating the seventh and eighth seed in each conference. Top two seeds get a bye. And then the first round is a five-game series. So the first round should take about a week and a half. And the top two seeds get a bye, which heavily incentivizes teams to not rest during the regular season, because getting a top two seed means that you don't have to play in the first round. No more playing like these dumb 7th and 8th seeds who have never done anything in a non-lockout season. Give them the bye. So that's my first thing. So this year, for example, it would have been Raptors, Bucks in the first round in the East, Wizards, Hawks in the first round. So those are the same first round series, except we skip the Celtics Bulls series and the Cavs Pacers series, which were ultimately not that fun.
So more like the NFL playoff structure, right? As far as the buys.
Exactly. And then it would have been, and then you take that first round, bring it back to five games, reward the first two teams with a bye, and that I think fixes a lot of things. The second part of this, the remaining 18 teams would pick in order of best record with the lottery. So instead of Brooklyn, who had the worst record in the regular season, getting the best odds for the first pick, and then ultimately that pick getting traded to Boston, Memphis would have had the best odds for the first pick. And then Indiana, Portland, Chicago, Miami. Those would have been your top five best odds for the number one pick in the draft. Does that make sense?
Explain that first part to me. How does that work out again?
So those remaining 18 teams that didn't make the playoffs,
right?
Instead of assigning odds based on worst record, you assign odds based on best record. So Memphis and Indiana were the last two teams out. They would have the best odds to get the first pick, not Brooklyn and Phoenix.
Wow. That's kind of bold, isn't it?
This is the way to fix the lottery, though, right? So this, if you wanted to fix the lottery where you just got rid of tanking and rewarded good teams and you didn't reward teams that just rested their starters like Phoenix, you know what I mean? This is the way to do it. So not only do you put more importance in the regular season by providing a first-round bye, which at least gives a lot more importance to the top two seeds, right? Because teams aren't going to tank or rest players if that means losing a couple of games and falling out of a bye. It would be more valuable to rest that whole first week and a half to 2 weeks of the playoffs. That's your rest. It's built in.
Okay.
So that gets rid of, and then you get rid of tanking by not just being able to suck and get the best odds. You have to actually get good to either make the playoffs, and because it's six teams and not eight teams in each conference, your odds are much better, right? And then you have that fifth round. Like, a sixth seed could beat the third seed in a five-game series. That seems much more logical than an eighth seed beating a one seed. So there's value to just making the playoffs now, as opposed to just making the playoffs as a seventh or an eighth seed. As we've seen time over the last few years, teams would rather be in the lottery with even a slim chance to move up than be the eighth seed and get swept in the first round. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So there's value to just drive either towards the playoffs or just be the last couple teams out and have a better chance of getting the first pick. The other reason I want to do this is because we could just keep giving crappy teams, aka the Kings, top 10 picks every year and they don't get any better. But if, let's say, Memphis ended up with the first pick, you put Markelle Fultz on the Grizzlies, all of a sudden they're a team maybe a year or two from now who can really compete in the West, as opposed to just kind of standing still. So now you get rid of that limbo where everybody wants to be or doesn't want to be. You know what I mean? We always talk about those teams in purgatory.
Right.
That's actually a good spot to be in, because you hit on one draft pick at the top of the draft, and bam, you go from purgatory to a competing team in your conference. You give Indiana the second pick in the draft, and they're able to take Lonzo Ball or Josh Jackson or Jason Tatum to pair with Paul George. Say that five times fast. That all of a sudden, maybe Paul George wants to stay in Indiana, and you're able to build a team around him. You give Portland a top five pick. You give Miami a top five pick. All of a sudden, these are teams that start getting better and try to knock off, you know, Cleveland or Golden State, where we've seen in these playoffs, it's been pointless. They've literally neither team has lost a game in the playoffs. It would even that competitive series. Now, would teams like Brooklyn and Sacramento still be at the bottom of the draft, or still just be bad and at the bottom of the league? Yeah, but they are anyway. Like, what difference does it make? It gives them more of an incentive to not trade those picks and to keep their picks and to be more competitive.
That's certainly an interesting proposal there. I hadn't come up with anything near as thorough as that, so I don't even know if it's worth.
There's a third part. Sorry.
There is. Okay. Yeah. Go for it.
Instead of drawing in the draft lottery, you only draw the top three, right? And then everybody falls in order.
Yeah.
You draw the top 18. So no matter like any team, like you can move up from 18 to 16 or from 18 to 3. Like it doesn't. Instead of just drawing the top three and then just letting everything else fall in place in order of record, let's draw all 18 teams. So that way there's more parity in that lottery. So that's the third part.
So that would be, so wouldn't that not incentivize people to play as hard as they could during the regular season if it's all going to be up in the air during the lottery anyway?
Well, you get better odds. Like you would still have better odds based on best record, but we would draw all 18 just because I think that would provide more intrigue on the lottery night.
Okay.
I think that would even out the playing field a little bit more as opposed to, okay, so Memphis, Indiana, and Portland would all just get, maybe they get the top three picks and everything else falls into place. It gives the chance for, like, the crappy teams. It gives a chance for, I guess, Sacramento to still move up and end up with a game-changing player. So.
Okay. For me, it was something much more simple. I just thought maybe, you know, promote playing your best during the regular season and to not actively encourage tanking as much as has been done in the past. Although I don't have a problem per se with the way Philadelphia built their team over the last few years, but I think that's something that more people in the league probably would want to change. I just thought something along the lines of maybe you couldn't have top three picks. Like let's say if you get a top three pick in this year, next year you couldn't possibly draft in the top three.
Oh, you're maxed at the fourth pick in the draft?
Like correct.
I like that.
The following year, you couldn't get a top five pick. By the third year, you couldn't, no matter what your odds are, your records are, you couldn't get a top 10 pick. So it promotes – it's not about necessarily promoting bad teams versus or growth that way. It just it punishes ineptitude with front offices, which I think is a necessary thing. It's like you can be a really bad team like the Kings and draft really badly and still continuously get rewarded for it. Even the Magic, you know, you wouldn't necessarily take a chance on a long-term project. It would be about getting the best player right now to ensure that you win right away. And that's why – and those odds keep getting worse and worse, you know. So and by year three, if you haven't gotten any better and you're still winning the top 10 as far as overall losing records, you still wouldn't be able to draft in the top 10 anyway. So you kind of get screwed that way. So it incentivizes you to play your best, to make sure that you're doing your best as a front office, not taking chances on bad players, not signing guys to long-term deals that could challenge the way that you do business, et cetera. It's just all about making the product better on a nightly basis, I think.
Encouraging steady development.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I like that idea. We can combine that with my idea, and I think we've really got something. Here's I had one other weird, this like completely wacky idea. You know how college football does like a committee to decide who makes the college football playoffs?
Yes.
What if you did a committee to decide the draft order?
That sounds terrible.
It does.
I think so. I think it's just because it's so subjective. Because
yeah, it would be completely subjective. You'd be able to make an event out of it, just like ESPN makes an event out of the college football playoff unveiling or the NCAA tournament. It is. We do subjective things like that with committees in almost every sport. I think it would be a lot of fun to get former players and media members or Condoleezza Rice or whatever like in on a committee to decide the draft order, and basically you would weigh different. Isn't Condoleezza Rice on the college football one?
If she is, I have no
that's
idea.
Where that came from. Just, I was just like,
I'm just waiting for like a player who's pissed off at Vlade Divac.
Yeah,
you know, he threw an elbow somewhere at him. Sacramento still playing.
Sacramento wouldn't be allowed to get a top three pick because they wouldn't want to reward him because of the ineptitude of that franchise. You would basically look at it and be like, all right, which of these teams are most deserving of the first pick? And chances are they'd probably say, you know what? We like how Miami did business this year. They get the number one pick.
Riley's got a lot of enemies, I think, you know? I mean, I wonder if that would work against the team or not.
Well, I think, all right, so you don't get like, you would get an objective committee then. Like me and you, for example. And
I don't know how objective we are sometimes.
And that's how you would do it. You would take certain things into play, like for the Heat, for example, right? They tried their butts off during the regular season. That's a point. Sure. That's a point in their favor, right? They get a gold star for that. The Chris Bosh freak accident, that sucks. Gold star for that, right? Like, you get, like, almost like compensatory picks in the NFL. Like,
oh boy.
That sucks. Like, you get bonus points for that. LeBron James left you, points for that. Dwayne Wade left, points for that. If a player leaves your team and signs a $15 million-plus dollar contract elsewhere, you get, like, a certain amount of points for that or something.
Wow.
I think
could you be bribed, Wes, if you were part of the committee?
Of course not. I have nothing but integrity.
That didn't sound believable at all, which is why it's such a terrible idea. I think a free In-N-Out burger and $5, and I'd be like, sure, you can get the top pick in the draft. I don't care.
But, like, I don't know. I would be really interested to see how that would break out.
That would be terrible. That would be so chaotic, and I think NBA Twitter would just explode at that point. I don't know.
It would drive so much conversation.
Negative conversation.
I mean, they do it already with all NBA teams.
Yeah, I don't want anything. And exactly, a subjective process that is impossible to weigh.
So you want
There's
more
no
fortune.
Way that you could say.
All right, yeah. So we go with our first idea. We combine yours with mine, and I think that's the right idea.
All right, let's move on. I
want to know what our listeners think, because this is a lot of fun. So whatever option you guys like the best, or come up with your own, email it to us at lockdownheat@gmail.com or tweet us at lockdownheat. All right, next question. We got to move on. From Taylor Monk, who apparently hates my crush on Zach Collins. This is our only pick for the next few years. Why draft a big when we have Hassan Whiteside? A backup big can be found for cheap. That's the question. I would like to respond directly to Taylor because he has a clear problem. This was in a reply on Twitter to our podcast where we talked about Zach Collins falling to the Heat.
Yep.
Zach Collins is more than just your backup center. He could possibly play alongside Hassan Whiteside at power forward.
Yep.
And he is not a unicorn, but closer on that spectrum than Whiteside is. He could shoot threes. He can play. He's a good two-way player today. Like, he could play defense at an NBA level right now. He can, and he's got room to grow on offense. He's not very athletic. He's not as athletic as Whiteside or some other unicorns, right? That's why he's not a unicorn, but he's a quasi-unicorn, a tiny unicorn. I don't know, whatever half of a unicorn is. That's what Zach Collins is, and so I wouldn't view him like getting it. Drafting the guy from like Justin Patton from Texas or something like that. That would be Ike Anembugu from UCLA. That would be a backup center, right? They can't play other positions. They're not versatile. They are backup centers. That I don't agree with. Zach Collins, I think he can do a little bit more.
You know, I'll pitch this as an example. You know, Miami in 2003 had Eddie Jones on the team. And they drafted Dwayne Wade. I guess you could rationalize that at the fifth pick in the draft, you didn't necessarily need a shooting guard, an undersized one at that, particularly at that point in time in the NBA, when you have a guy like Eddie Jones who made the All-Star team. Now, that's not to say that Eddie Jones at that point in his career was playing at the same level that Whiteside is playing currently. But I don't think you necessarily are limited by who you currently have on the roster if you can – you know, if you're willing to take a guy, or if there's an opportunity to take a guy who could possibly be a star. Now, I'm not saying Zach Collins is in the same breath of air as Dwayne Wade is, and I don't think anybody expects his career to develop in that same path. But I think just having Whiteside on the team doesn't necessarily limit your options as far as who you can draft. And I think one of the points that we made when we were talking about Collins and the draft in general is that Whiteside's style of play is a little anachronistic. It's a little outdated. You know, that mode of center is falling to the wayside just a little bit. And you don't know with Whiteside in particular whether or not he has enough dominant performances being an aberration across the league to justify him being the quote-unquote star of your team. Right? We saw where Miami was most effective in the second half of the season. Whiteside was reduced to a tertiary role. That's an awful lot of money to be paying a guy who's your third best option offensively in order for Miami just to get a better chance of succeeding. So if you can get a guy who could potentially supplant Whiteside, make Whiteside expendable, I don't see why you wouldn't. Now, I'm not necessarily as high on Collins as you are, but I like the idea of potentially getting somebody who can change the game, making more dynamic offensively without sacrificing a whole hell of a lot defensively, which I think is what the potential for Collins is.
All right, next question. This comes from Mark. After further assessment, Caleb Swanigan is my guy. Fills a position of need at power forward. Reminds me of a young Zach Randolph. He is a strong scorer inside, developed as a good three-point shooter. He's a good passer, which would benefit Whiteside. Higher upside on both ends of the floor than Justin Jackson, for example, who a lot of mock drafts are kind of slotting Justin Jackson into where the Heat are picking or whereabouts. Our thoughts. So that's our question. The Zach Randolph comparison is fine. I also kind of look at like an Al Jefferson type, maybe like Al Jefferson with a three-point shot is probably his best case scenario.
That's really best case scenario.
Really like super best case. Like
he's in the Ringer's draft kind of breakdown.
Yeah.
They list his best case scenario. I don't know if you saw this. As Brandon Bass. Yeah, Jared Sullinger and Jason McSteel.
And we're going to sign Jared Sullinger anyway. So we're going to have that player next season. So
Swanigan out of Purdue, obviously, is listed at 6'9", generously listed at 247 pounds. He looks like he's probably a little heavier than that.
Maybe got a little, like another 40 pounds. Like, let's throw an extra 40 pounds on there.
He could be, he's probably closer to 6'8 and 260 than 6'9", 247, 100%. I'd say.
Yeah, and look, even if he is let's say he is Zach Randolph or Al Jefferson, right? That type of player doesn't have a big spot in today's NBA. We're seeing players like that come off the bench. Greg Monroe is a lot like that. Jahlil Okafor is that. Enes Kanter is that for Oklahoma City. Like that, they are bigs who can't play great defense, who can are very like talented on offense and on the offensive boards. Like they rebound at a high rate. You know, they've got a couple go-to post moves. They can spread the floor a little bit with at least a mid-range shot, and in like Kanter's case, sometimes even hit a three-pointer. But that if you can't play defense and you're immobile, that player just doesn't have as much of a position in today's NBA. They can't switch. They can't get onto smaller guys on the perimeter. That's the problem. And Swanigan, he just doesn't have a high ceiling on the defensive end. He's not extremely athletic. He's not very fluid. He's got this, he got better conditioning in Purdue, and you could argue if he were to go to Miami, his conditioning would be a lot better. But just athletically, he has a ceiling, which is why right now he's looking at he looks like a second round pick, just because that defense is such a major concern. I just don't see him being able to defend at better than an average level in the NBA. Yeah. And that's just that kind of player just comes off the bench today, which is a nice player to have if you're paying him like a second round pick.
Exactly.
As long as you're not paying them like Greg Monroe or Enes Kanter, that's fine. So maybe he falls in the second round. Miami buys a second round pick and they take him. But I also I'm not sure that they need that player.
Yeah, I think you'd want, as we talked before, somebody with a little bit more versatility who can play a number of positions. He's pretty limited. Maybe you could put him as a center position, but at most, I'm thinking of a lot of fours. Like, let's look at who our best option to start at power forward next season would be, and that's James Johnson.
Yep.
He would toast Swanigan. And I mean, I know a lot of that could be the fact that he's just a very young rookie and he still needs to develop a lot of, but I mean, James Jones comes off the bench for Miami and he's at least 10 times quicker than Swanigan at this point. His handle is much more developed. His outside shooting, Swanigan has none of those things. He doesn't have the handle. He doesn't have the quickness of feet to move and guard guys on the perimeter, which a lot of forwards in today's game have. Even centers sometimes do.
Yep.
Let's look at other backup centers like Mike Muscala, Frank Kaminsky. Those are backup centers that are in the Southeast Division. Nikola Vucevic, who can shoot from the perimeter as well. Yeah. Does Swanigan have the kind of speed and dexterity to guard
those guys? Would toast him. Those guys would toast him.
Exactly. Yeah, they would go off for 15, 20 points per game with him on there. And he's just – I like the fact that he can score in a low post. Again, it's a very anachronistic style of play. It's good to have him, again, like you pointed out, at a very low salary as a backup. But that's still a risk. I could see a guy like this dropping pretty heavily in the draft.
And let's just remember that Eric Spoelstra and the Heat don't have a lot of patience for guys who can't defend.
Oh, without a doubt.
So that might not be a great pick. All right, here's our last question for part one of the mailbag. We'll have part two coming up later this week, but here's the last question for this one, coming from Billy Kuhn. Hypothetical trade. You thought we'd get through a whole thing without a hypothetical trade. All right, this is a three-teamer. Let's get weird, guys. All right, here it is. So Miami, I don't know. How do we start this? Okay. The Washington Wizards get Paul George and Roddy Magruder. The Indiana Pacers get Markieff Morris, Tyler Johnson, Kelly Oubre Jr., my boy. And the Miami Heat get Otto Porter Jr. In addition to this, the Pacers also get Miami's 2017 first-round pick at 14 and Washington's 2019 first-round pick. They don't have a first-round pick this year. The Heat will receive second-rounders from both Washington and Indiana for this draft. So Miami would they lose their first-round pick this year, but they gain two second-rounders. They get Otto Porter Jr. Paul George goes to Washington. Indiana gets a bunch of depth with Oubre, Tyler Johnson, and Markieff Morris. What do you think, David?
That's a tough one. I think, as you pointed out, that might be an interesting option for Miami. I think Miami clearly comes out on top there.
I forgot to mention, sorry. I added Billy Kuhn's original question didn't have Markieff Morris. I threw that into here because of salary matching purposes. But sorry, go continue.
No, not at all. So I think for Miami, the opportunity to get a young, talented swing player like Porter who could play the 2 through 4 and guard multiple positions. He's a very good defender, obviously a very good three-point shooter. At least he developed into one this season. A guy who's still young enough to develop a secondary move. His handle is a little suspect at this point, but I think, again, it's something that he can continue to work on. Whether or not he'll ever turn into a superstar is debatable, but at this point he's obviously an upgrade over anybody we have at the swing position. So for Miami, I think it's great. Not only that, but you basically don't unload much other than a draft pick this year, which obviously Pat Riley is more than willing to do. Tyler Johnson's salary would come off the book. So although you take a hit as far as your overall depth, you wouldn't have to pay him $20 million next year. So that leaves you the opportunity to sign other guys as free agents. Maybe you get a power forward next season as a free agent. Maybe you can still acquire Gordon Hayward, somebody like that. So, I mean, there are lots of options there for Miami, and I think that's it's a very interesting one.
Yeah. For Washington, I think it's interesting because I guess the idea is try to bring Paul George in for a season, convince him that Washington playing alongside John Wall and Bradley Beal is the place for him to be. For Indiana, right, you're getting a lot of depth. You're upgrading a few positions. But ultimately, I don't think it's a trade that works because I think there are better offers out there for Indiana. None of these picks are top five. Washington right. in 2019, probably still, even if Paul George were to walk away, they're not losing a whole lot in this deal. Like, you're losing Otto Porter, Oubre, and Markieff Morris, but they've still got Beal and Wall to build around. They're probably that pick's probably not falling into the top five. And for Miami, you can always make an offer to Otto Porter Jr. as a restricted free agent. You don't have to give up all of this stuff. Or like you said, you can go out and maybe chase other free agents at that point. I like Otto Porter Jr. a lot for the Heat. I think it's a really good fit. There might be other ways to get him. And for Washington, I just don't see them doing it. I think Paul George, I don't know that. I mean, maybe they would, but out of desperation, I don't know what other, if you're the Wizards and you're trying to beat LeBron in the East, this might be the only way to do it. I don't really see, you don't have a first round pick this year. Maybe it does take a swing for the fences type move to do this, but I also think Indiana ultimately would get better offers for Paul George, but who knows? Maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, Washington's depth was a big issue all season long. You saw that in the pivotal Game 7 against the Boston Celtics where Scott Brooks only went to, what, it was 7 or 8 players.
Yeah.
Didn't even play Oubre on that game, so clearly not a lot of confidence there. But to take a hit as far as overall team depth, you're losing your starter in Porter. You're losing your starter in Markieff Morris. You're trading away a first-round pick. And you get Roddy Magruder, who's a solid player, but not necessarily a star, and ultimately plays the same position as Paul George does. So you're either getting Magruder as a backup, which is fine, but he's not necessarily a strong six-man candidate or anything like that. And then you get Paul George, who's not been willing to play the power forward position. You still have an issue there at power forward since you traded away Morris. I mean, and you still have Mahimi and Gortat on the books, which one of those is likely to be traded at some point
this
summer. So
they need to get rid of one of those. It's like the major thing here. And they're not doing that in this trade. But still interesting to, you know, we love the hypothetical trades. We love to break them down. But ultimately, We're not feeling that one. Don't think it's one that works.
Anyway. Thanks anyway, Billy.
Yes, thanks anyway, Billy. That's all we have for today. That was part one of the mailbag. Part two will be out later this week, whether you're listening on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get podcasts. Thank you for listening. You can send mailbag questions or get information about advertising on the show by sending an email to lockedonheat@gmail.com. To support the show, make sure you download every episode and follow Locked On Heat on Twitter. Thank you to SeatGeek, the friendliest and smartest way to find tickets for any game, concert, or show you want to go to. Download the SeatGeek app and enter the promo code LOHEAT to get a $20 rebate off your first ticket purchase. If you're not subscribed already, please do so to get the podcast automatically every day. Then go to iTunes, rate us, review us, say nice things about us. We'll catch you next time. Thanks for joining me, David.
You got it, Wes.